Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav, where Rory McIlroy seemingly waited forever to win the Masters Tournament. And this time, all he had to wait was an extra year. Rex, he is the fourth player Rory McIlroy is to defend successfully his title at the Masters. How would you grade this 90th Masters, the 2026 edition?
It's got to be an A+, right? I mean, we can sit here and talk about...
A+! An instant classic, you say?
Instant classic, because we can sit here and talk about what went wrong on Saturday after a 6-shot lead, and you declared him the winner on Friday night, and he blew that lead, and no one had ever led.
He did.
He did. He ended up winning. You're right. You're absolutely correct. We can sit here and debate that all you want, but I think the back and forth is what makes the Masters so great. We had it on Saturday. I don't think you and I have ever experienced a Saturday like that at the Masters. I mean, you were breathless. I cannot sit next to you when you're like that, because you're hitting me. You're very physical. You're very loud. You're very vocal in that situation. But Sunday was even better because you had so many players in the mix. We could have gone into Saturday. I mean, let's consider the scenarios. We could have gone into Sunday with Rory leading by 6 or possibly more. And if he didn't win by 12, it wasn't going to be entertaining. I either wanted 12 or 1, because anything in between is a little on the boring side. And we got the exactly what I would argue you wanted. You have so many players in the mix. You had Cam Young, who stumbled early. You had Rory McIlroy, who stumbled early. You had Justin Rose, who charged early. It's the ingredients. It's the secret sauce of what makes the Masters so special.
You call A+. Typically, you're the harsh grader.
So I'm the tough grader, but I loved it. I loved it.
I loved it as well. The only reason I would call it an A is because the last 5 holes, yes, it was certainly tense. Yes, there were certainly some moments where you're projecting ahead and thinking what could potentially happen. I'm thinking potentially Rory McIlroy not getting up and down behind 16. Scottie Scheffler narrowly missing his birdie putt on the 71st hole. You could have had the top 2 players in the world, the top 2 players of their generation going toe-to-toe for a Masters title. Yes, I think all of us would have signed up for that. The reason why, Rex, I love this Sunday as well, you had 3 different players who at one point or another on Masters Sunday had at least a 2-shot lead. And how we do this job in this business as writers and journalists and now podcasters and video people is that you start projecting the storylines and what you're going to potentially write about them and what sort of narrative arc are you going to be established with them. I had all 3 of those ready to go. I had a Justin Rose story, and finally, at the age of 45, he's breaking through to become the second oldest Masters champion after being denied 3 times previously. I was thinking about Cameron Young and the stamping of a young star, a player who, just like Rory, just like Scottie, over the past couple of years, had won the Players' Championship, then a month later won the Masters Tournament, staring down, again, a historic figure in the game, and Rory McIlroy to an elusive green jacket. That didn't happen as well. Instead, I think we got a pretty satisfying ending as well. Yeah. Masters title number 2 for Rory McIlroy. Major championship title number 6 for Rory McIlroy, which stamps him, in my opinion, as the best European golfer ever. Yes, it was that kind of historic Sunday.
And I think that's when we sat here last year. Let's take the time back machine. Let's go back to 12 months ago when you and I were doing this exact same podcast on Sunday night after Rory had won his first Masters, completed the career Grand Slam. I think both of us were a little flummoxed with the idea of what's next for Rory. Like, we could celebrate this. I mean, him walking up the hill and the ugly crying and all of the emotion that we ran into, that was really special. But you and I are not prisoners of the moment. We started looking ahead almost immediately. And I love the idea that now, 12 months later, he's sort of delivered and what the answer is. I had a chance to catch up with Brad Fax and his putting coach. He was on his way home. He was driving to South Florida, by the way, Brad Fax, and you should not be watching Masters coverage while you're driving down I-95. It can be very dangerous. But he pointed out to me that now, all of a sudden, there's so many other milestones for Rory to think about. Clearly, being the best European ever was on his to-do list. That was on his CV. That's what he wanted to do. And I think, check, you're absolutely right. But then Fax brought up a really interesting part that maybe he gets motivated about winning all of the majors again twice. The double Grand Slam. There's only 3 other people that have done that. And now all of a sudden, you even go into an even more elite category. And Rory didn't say that, but he certainly said in his press conference afterward the idea that, I don't want to put a number on it, but I feel like I'm in my prime. I'm playing some of the best golf of my life. My body is in the best shape it's ever been. My mind is exactly where I want it to be. I have discovered the formula, and there's no 2 ways about it. By the way, Freddie Couples, Well done. You might be right. Freddie made every single Masters from now to the end of time. I think that's what he has discovered. Like, he has not played another course in essentially 3 weeks since the Players Championship. He said he started to feel like Augusta National was his home course, which is a bit of a stretch when you know everything we know about Augusta National. But you're never going to be that intense. You can never be that intense going into the other majors. But if you apply that just a little bit, it's really cool to think what could be next for Rory. When you and I were sitting here a year ago and trying to figure out, what's the motivation? He got to the top of the mountain. Where do you go from here?
Yeah, I want to put a pin in the preparation because I think that was an important piece that allowed him to win this Masters tournament as it relates to sort of the journey and the destination that Rory spent the past couple of days talking about. He and I think everyone else sort of viewed the career Grand Slam as a capstone to what is a legendary career. And he was now a living legend and achieving everything at the age of 36 that the boyhood wonder could have possibly conjured up. And I think it was natural to have that letdown, to have that month or two period where he was pondering what next. And we saw that. We saw how it played out at the PGA Championship. We saw how it played out in Canada. We saw how it played out at the US Open. It wasn't until Portrush, Rex, where I think it really sort of crystallized for Rory McIlroy what he wanted to achieve and what he wanted to do. And that was really to check off major championship titles, huge national opens at places that are important to him and places that are important in the game's long history. And I'm totally with you. I think completing the career Grand Slam a second time is going to be hugely motivational for him. I think winning a US Open next year at Pebble, winning an Open Championship at St. Andrews, I think potentially becoming the greatest non-American major champion of all time, best international player of all time, I think could be something that he's gunning for as well. And he mentioned it, Rex, the resetting of thinking that it wasn't necessarily the destination was completing the career Grand Slam. Now it's more talking about little stops along the journey. And you can just hear Dr. Bob Rotella oozing out of what Rory McIlroy was saying to the reporters on Sunday. I think it's a very healthy way to look at it, but I am curious to see where it goes from here, because Rory McIlroy is playing as good a golf as ever, as well-rounded as he ever, and certainly is in a good mental space. As it relates to Masters Sunday, and specifically what he did in the round of 71, what really stood out to you about the performance and how he eventually got it done?
When he got two down, when you imagine the mental, let's call it where he was frame of mind-wise, on Friday with a six-stroke lead going into Saturday. And no one's ever had that big of a lead going into the weekend at the Masters. To essentially spit that lead up, I mean, you have to think about where his mind was on Saturday night. It was probably spinning. He went to the range. I reported it early on live from on Sunday morning that he hit almost the exact same number of balls after his round as he hit before his round. He was clearly searching for something, and all of them were in the 150 to 200 yard mark. And he talked about it after the round. He was quick. The swing pack was way too far out to the right. Everything was going left. He didn't know how to control it. And he went to the range and hit 47 balls and really just tried to focus on neutralizing his swing path. And he got into a good frame of mind. He got to a place that he felt like he was comfortable. Now, fast forward to Sunday morning, you and I talked about this as well on the Reporters Roundtable on Live From. When you go back to last year, and he bogeys the last hole, the 72nd hole, and now he's in a playoff with Justin Rose. When he got in that golf cart, and Harry Diamond turned to him and said, "Well, pal, if I'd have told you this on Monday, you would have taken it. Like, if I'd have told you you're going to be in a playoff to win the Masters, you would have taken it." And it was, I think it was a similar reset. I think his mind was in the exact same place that, all right, things didn't work out the way I wanted to on Saturday. That's not the way I wanted everything to play out. But I still have a chance. I'm still tied for the lead. I have 18 holes to play on a golf course that I have absolutely dominated for Thursday and Friday. There's no reason to think I can't do it again. And yet, it didn't go to plan. It didn't go to script. I always go back to the Mike Tyson line that, yeah, everyone's got a plan until you get punched in the mouth. And Rory seemed to have gotten punched in the mouth a lot over the weekend. And yet, once he got to the second nine, something just clicked. You saw a calmness about him. You saw, I think you only said it I'm going to estimate here, about 3,000 times, that after the shot on seven, that everything sort of fell into place. And I tend to agree with you, because he just felt comfortable hitting the fade. Suddenly he was controlling the club face the way he wanted. Suddenly he felt like the golf ball was going where he was looking. There was no panic whatsoever.
I mean, it was pretty easy to see that Saturday was the statistical anomaly, that in tournament competition, you're rarely going to have 72 flawless holes. You're not going to have every round just be absolutely sublime golf. And so I looked at what happened on Saturday and the fact that he was 6.5 shots, strokes gained, worse on Saturday than he was on Friday. It was sort of ironic that the advantage that he had built, and again, a six-shot lead, no one had ever in the history of the Masters had a six-shot lead through 36 holes. He had done that predominantly on the strength of great iron play and really tidy wedge play and really sharp short game and putting. Yes, it was the driver that had sort of betrayed him, the fact that he had not hit a single fairway on a par five and yet was seven under on the longest holes through two rounds. And so the fact that he got into sort of a bad swing flow on Saturday, as you mentioned, swinging into out, either hitting draws or hitting those sort of like pull hooks. So when he went to the tournament practice area on Saturday evening, he worked on trying to hit a cut. And I think everyone had a little bit of a uh-oh moment on the par three fourth hole on Sunday, where Rory once again pulled it long and left into the greenside bunker, ended up three putting from inside 10 feet and walked off with a double bogey. That to me was a really troubling sign, which is why I said over and over again that that tee shot on seven was so important, because he teed it down, he aimed left, and he hit sort of a bullet squeeze cut that left him a sand wedge into the seventh green. He was able to spin it close. He made birdie and he was off and running. And to me, it was the seven hole stretch beginning at number seven that won him this golf tournament. He played that seven hole stretch in four under par. That included the birdie on seven. That included a two putt birdie on eight after once again he hit the fairway on the eighth hole. You look at what happened on 12, a beautiful shot, a hold off three quarter nine iron that a day earlier, Rex, when he was trying to play sort of a toned down three quarter shot, had pulled long and left. This time he waited using a tip he'd received from Tom Watson, where you just sort of stand on the tee and wait for the wind that you were expecting, and then go ahead, put the peg in the ground and go ahead and hit it. Rory did exactly that, waited for the wind, hit it, great shot inside 10 feet, followed it up on the par five, missed left, rolled it out to about 11 feet, and he makes birdie. Those seven holes, four under par, was able to play those last five holes with a comfortable cushion, but it all started on that seventh hole hitting sort of a cut, which is the exact same thing that he had worked on less than 24 hours earlier in the tournament practice area.
I love pulling back the curtain sometimes. You and I sit next to each other at most tournaments, but at the Masters, it's kind of
every tournament.
Every tournament. It's tight, kind of tight quarters. You can agree with that. And I think I had two things today that you told me to write that down. That's your way of saying that, yes, I think you need to hold on to that. So write that down. One of them was the way he played aiming corner. So he played aiming corner today, just specifically to Sunday, in two under par. He birdied the 11th, he birdied the 13th hole. Both brilliant holes, and I think what he was able to accomplish there went a long way to building that lead. So he got to 18, he had the two-stroke lead, he had the cushion, he had exactly what he was looking for. Go back to last year, when he was playing the same aim in corner in a very, very similar situation in the tournament, where he'd given up a lead. He was trying to play catch up. He played it in three over. So I think I called it strokes gain aim in corner. He was plus five. I think that's a big part about what he was able to accomplish on Sunday. I think the other part of this was that I wrote down is the idea that he was able to go out and control the narrative, is the way I would put it. That even though he fell behind, you never saw any panic. And I think in his press conference, he said it really helped that he birdied 7 and 8, that he had fallen two strokes back, but then suddenly he was able to birdie 7 and 8 and get right back into it.
Yeah, I also want to touch, Rex, on the fact that the differences between last year's tournament and this year's tournament. And there was sort of this narrative that Rory was going to be unlocked and he was going to be unburdened. And I think everyone would agree that there is no pressure situation that Rory is going to feel that is as intense and as suffocating as what he experienced last year. The stakes, the most consequential round, one of the most consequential rounds in the history of the sport. And I think the uncomfortable dynamic of playing alongside Bryson DeChambeau, even though Rory had a 2-shot lead, just because of the history that they had together, the contrasting of styles, the polarizing and partisan crowds that were going to be either pro Rory or pro Bryson. That was a very uncomfortable pairing for Rory McIlroy, and it really added up to one of the most stressful major championships we have ever seen. And Rory's thought was that, boy, you know, all of the pressure of trying to complete the Grand Slam and trying to win the Masters really added to it. And what he realized walking off the 18th green on Sunday at Augusta National was, it's just hard to win the Masters, period. I think there's certain characteristics of the golf course where it's really high risk, high reward, a really small margin for error. And I think we saw that on 15 with the wedge shot that he didn't hit quite how he wanted to. He said the wind knocked it down, and all of a sudden that ball carries by, I don't know, mere inches from potentially rolling back into the water on 15. And then we're having a potentially completely different conversation right now, but also just the history and the stakes and the legacies for the players that are competing. That's why I marvel at what Scottie Scheffler has been able to do over the past 5 years, winning 2 green jackets, being competitive in every other Masters in which he did not win. You always see players, Rex, sort of fade from contention. And we had a couple of early ejections. We had Hao Tong Li. We had Shane Lowry. We had Sam Burns, even though he was able to rally at some point. The air gets real thin on Masters Sunday. Yeah. Rory McIlroy has experienced the good and the bad at Augusta National, but I think it also goes to show that these players are also just built differently if they are able to withstand the pressure and withstand the rigors of this golf course and this championship.
And I think, and I also pointed out that this might be the first time in the history of the Masters, we don't have a good, you and I don't have a stats guide to look this up for us, but this might be the first time that you had back-to-back champions that made double bogeys in the final rounds. That seems almost statistically impossible. But when you look at what he was able to accomplish, and you're absolutely right, the air does get very thin. We're going to get into the other players that happened around Rory. But there was two parts, and I kind of did this report earlier on Sunday on Live From that. One, having the green jacket is always going to help. Having won it, having known that you got a space in the champions locker room upstairs, that you have a space on that table on Tuesday and it, for the rest of your life, that you are part of the club and nothing's going to take that from you. That's always going to help. But you said we were going to circle back around to it. I don't think you can lean into the preparation enough. I think the idea that I think by best estimates, maybe 7 to 10 days, he spent at Augusta National since the Players' Championship playing, practicing, learning the nuances of the golf course. I don't think you can overstate that. I think it's an amazing accomplishment what he was able to do, because he said, and he put himself in some really weird positions. And I do want to talk about 16. I wasn't in the press conference, but if I was, the one question I would have asked is, did you envision the 16th hole? He flew the green. He was kind of in the Tiger spot from, you know, the kind famous of, Tiger spot. And he did everything except for hold that shot. Like, it won't become a famous commercial the way Tiger's did, but it was an amazing shot. Like, the fact that he was even able to stop that ball, it shows you how well he was able to execute it. I just think the preparation was the key here. The time he spent up here, the time he felt being comfortable on the golf course, he said it in his press conference. There was no corner of that golf course that he felt like he couldn't get up and down from. And we saw it. Like, if you look at his stats, he putted well statistically. He hit his irons well statistically. Driving it, I think he was probably below average for him relative to what he normally does. But it's around the greens that he really made up the most ground.
Yeah, I'm glad that you transitioned there. That's exactly where I wanted to go. And look, hand up, mea culpa. I was among those who thought Rory McIlroy was making a mistake after leaving the Players Championship, not adding a tournament start, most notably looking.
Why would you think that?
Again, Scottie Scheffler did not play either because of the birth of his second child. I just thought that we had not seen enough, at least in PGA Tour competition, to feel really good, or Rory McIlroy should not feel all that good about what he had put together sort of on game tape heading into the year's first major. Rory felt differently, and he was proved correct. You mentioned it, Rex. More than 7 days combined at Augusta National, sometimes spending 27 holes and just spinning around in the ultimate flex, the ultimate luxury. He mentioned dropping his daughter Poppy off at school, buzzing up to Augusta, taking a couple spins around the golf course, jetting back to South Florida and meeting with her and wife Erica for dinner. It was the amount of preparation that he put in. And it wasn't just, you know, chipping and putting. And that certainly played a part of it, sort of refamiliarizing himself with the slopes and the contours. And you know, we've seen countless and heard countless players say, you know, I don't really like going up for the scouting trips anymore. I didn't find it all that fruitful because there's such a difference in how Augusta National plays non-tournament weeks and what you did when you get it up to tournament speed. Rory McIlroy essentially scoffed at that notion. Just being on property, getting comfortable, seeing the slopes, seeing the angles, playing the golf course. He just said there was such a value in playing with one ball and seeing what scores you have. And I think you did see, Rex, some of that preparation bleed out into the actual tournament. Some of the spots that he put himself, and I'm not just talking about off the tee and sort of the pine straw, but I think really some of the leaves he had. I'm thinking about going left on number two and having that angle. Some of the other shots behind six, although he didn't quite pull it off with an up and down on Sunday, giving himself those opportunities 16. And seeing how the ball.
I mean, is clearly going to react. He had hit that 16, chip shot before on 16.
16, certainly. Going up to sort of where the layup zone was going to be on 13 and trying to get a better handle on that than he certainly did a year ago. Playing right of 11, getting used to that shot. There are so many different spots. 17 is a perfect example as well. We saw him sort of play the angles and the pitch out both on Saturday and Sunday when he mishit the 8-iron that he did in the 71st hole, leaving himself that shot. Yes, it's a difficult chip. Yes, it's a little bit of a tricky up and down, but he was able to pull it off on Sunday when he desperately needed it and was able to play the last hole with a two-shot cushion. So it's just having experience, being comfortable, and I'm very curious to see not just if Rory is going to adapt that for other major championships, and in fact, he said that he was going to. He said he had a conversation a couple years ago with Jack Nicklaus where Jack would always go to the tournament venues a week ahead of time and play upwards of four sort of simulated rounds and just getting ball in hand and seeing how it was going to go and then going home and having sort of his final preps for a major championship week. That might be a little intense, but it wouldn't be completely surprising to see Rory McIlroy do it. Also curious to see if Rory's peers follow suit. I'm thinking of John Rahm, who we talked about in the next segment as well, if he adapts some of the pre-tournament preparations.
Yeah, clearly that's just not realistic when you look at, I mean, the next major at Roenick in Philadelphia, and you have two signature events the week before, and Rory is going to unwind. He's not playing next week in Hilton Head, which is also a signature event. He's not playing the week after that, Zurich Classic. So he's taking essentially 2 weeks off. My guess is he's going to play Doral and then head up to the Truist Championship in Charlotte. You just don't have the real estate with the way that the schedule is condensed right now. And then I'm not even going to get into what it might look like in 2027 and beyond. I think that's a bigger issue, but you're absolutely right. I think what he was able to do here is a case study. And you always hear the stories about guys want to come up and play the scouting rounds. You want to play the Augusta National because it's Augusta National more than anything else. But how many players have told us that the conditions aren't the same, that it's soft? You really don't get an idea for exactly the way it's going to be during the tournament. And that's got to be the case this week. We're going to get into it. It was as firm and fast and dry and crusty as I've ever seen this golf course. And yet it's clear that Rory McIlroy learned something about the golf course over that 3 week stretch and all of those practice rounds he played. I want to just touch on one thing before we're done with Rory here in this first block. And the idea is, and I think we've talked about it on Live from the last 2 days, is he a top 10 player? And I thought Jaime Diaz, you and I did a couple of roundtables with him this week. Jaime, you did excellent work. Quit beating yourself up. Jaime's tough on himself.
He is. Yeah, Jaime would leave his credential on. He left his glasses on. He dropped his notebook
during a segment.
About a 4 day spin. But on Sunday, chef's kiss, absolutely nailed it.
Killed it. And I think he did a good job of putting the context of, because I think you and I sometimes can be prisoners of the moment when we look at, is he a top 10 player? And my reaction was, well, of course he is. Like, he's the best European ever now. I'm not quite sure how that's out of the conversation. And you're right. Maybe the best international player would be the next step with an eye towards Gary Player, maybe Ernie Els on that front, whatever the next step is. I feel like he is, but I feel like Jaime did a good job of sort of going down the list of players and laying out their resumes and being a little bit more realistic than maybe I was, being a prisoner of the moment. But I would turn it on you. After this win, I feel like it's not even in the conversation anymore. I feel like that Rory McIlroy is on the Mount Rushmore, however many faces you want to put on there, of golf.
It certainly seems that way, and I'll leave it to the dean of Jaime Diaz, who put a lot more thought into it than you sort of spring out on me in the spur of the moment here. I mean, it's impossible to compare eras. It's impossible to sort of evaluate what Gene Sarazen did versus what Roy McIlroy is doing in 2026. The game is completely changed. The equipment's completely changed. The competition's completely changed. The golf courses have completely changed. I think it's really, really difficult. I think you'd be hard pressed to find 10 other golfers who have had a better resume than Roy McIlroy. And look, I think the most encouraging part is he's not done. I think it's very possible at this point in his career that he's still capable of producing a second or even a third prime at this point, if you want to look at some of the chapters that he's had in his career in the various stages in the various eras of Roy McIlroy. I wouldn't put it past him. He's not done winning major championships. And that's what Rory said on Sunday night as well at Augusta National. He's not done here. He's not stopping anytime soon. All right, that puts a bow on Roy McIlroy's 2026 Masters, but it was plenty busy at Augusta National for Scottie Scheffler, Justin Rose, Cameron Young, and even John Rahm and Bryson DeChambeau with their disappointing weeks as well. After the break, we'll be breaking down all of their performances and what it means. Stay with us. All right, Rex, Roy McIlroy won the Masters, but history will show that the top three players in the world ranking were also top three on the leaderboard at Augusta National. Not exactly in that order, but Scottie Scheffler solo second, and Cameron Young, the players champion, among the group in joint third. Which of those players who did not win at Augusta National really stood out to you on Sunday or for the week in general?
All of them. It's why I gave this an A+. I mean, you just kind of justified my whole grade. The idea that not only did we get the winner that I think a lot of people wanted, that sort of the story that a lot of people wanted, Roy McIlroy, but you also had all of the drama, and it was drama by the top players in the game. I'll start with Scottie Scheffler, because I think when you look at the arc of Scottie Scheffler's season, where we had talked a lot about things just weren't right statistically for him. The ball striking just didn't add up. Whether if he said it or not, and he would probably argue that he was just a little bit off, or maybe he missed a shot here and there, but the stats don't lie. He's in the 80s when it comes to strokes gain approach. He's been first on that category the last two seasons on the PGA Tour. As you pointed out numerous times, his proximity is way off. We can keep going down the list. Like, things just weren't quite right going into the Masters, certainly through the Florida swing. And it, he had two finishes outside the top 20, which is nothing to panic about. But when it's Scottie Scheffler and you're used to this level of excellence, certainly you're going to pay attention to it. And then you end up with what we got for the first two rounds. And Thursday was okay. Friday wasn't good at all. He shot 74 on Friday, essentially felt like he played his way out of the tournament. He didn't. He still ended up having a really good chance on Sunday. And I will say, there always seems to be sort of that epiphany moment when it comes to Scottie Scheffler. And that seemed to happen Friday night on the range with his swing coach, Randy Smith. I was texting back and forth with Randy, and he said he just kind of found his rhythm and he found a way to be a little bit more aggressive through the ball. And I think that's what we saw through the course of the weekend. And even Scottie pointed it out when we spoke to him after his round on Sunday, to be 12 shots off the lead through 36 holes and then to finish up one shot back. And you had a lot of opportunities to sort of close that gap coming down the stretch that you weren't able to convert. I think Scottie takes a lot of momentum from this, even though he didn't win. And I know that sounds silly when you're talking about the world number one, but you can't ignore what had happened to him through the course of this season. Since he won at the American Express, the ball striking had been a concern. And I think what we saw over the course of the weekend was much more in line with what we come to expect from Scottie Scheffler.
I mean, he's just so unbelievable. He is inevitable. He was irrepressible. And this is a player who you mentioned was 12 shots behind at the halfway point. All Roy McIlroy did on the weekend was shoot even par, and it was good enough. But it was good enough just barely, because Scottie Scheffler caught fire, bogey for 65 on Saturday, shot 68 in the final round. There's just no give up in him. I think that's one of his most admirable qualities, even if he didn't necessarily have it. And he certainly did it on Friday, shooting 74. I believe that was the second worst score of his Masters career. To be able to put together this performance was very, very impressive. I do think that he does have a point. And if you missed this press conference on Sunday, Scotty was talking about the difference in the course conditions between what they were experiencing on Thursday afternoon and what happened 24 hours later, essentially, for the early late starters. And Rory McIlroy was among that group and just having sort of really soft, benign, receptive conditions. And obviously weather changes and it wasn't nearly as windy. You had some more moisture in the air. You had some more humidity. The greens were a little bit softer and you were able to attack. But I do think, Rex, that Scotty has a point, that something happened on Thursday evening. Something dramatically changed with the golf course, because every player who came into the flash area on Thursday, and you and I were out there, was speaking very ominously about what this 90th Masters was going to turn into. It was going to be some sort of horror show, and that Augusta National could do exactly what they wanted to do to the golf course, and it was going to potentially be really, really challenging, if not impossible, particularly when you saw par five greens like 13 and 50 on Thursday afternoon that were really difficult to hold, even with a wedge. Something dramatic happened. And yes, Scottie Scheffler shot 74 on Friday morning in really benign receptive conditions. There's no denying that. That is where Scottie Scheffler lost the golf tournament, was on Friday morning. But I can't help but think, Rex, that I know why they do it, but putting star players in the second to last grouping on Thursday and Friday, and I know why they do it. I'm not naive. They're trying to put those players in the TV windows and trying to maximize the exposure for those players. But it's also a pretty significant disadvantage when the conditions are like that. If you were trying to, quote unquote, maximize the scoring opportunities for the best players, they'd be going somewhere in the range of like 10 to 1. But to have them put second to last group, the penultimate group of the day, when there's the most foot traffic, when the greens are the most baked out, when the greens are the firmest, when the greens are the slickest, and the greens are the most chewed up, I do think there is a point that that was the most difficult conditions that you could have possibly played in on Thursday afternoon, and Scottie Scheffler was firmly stuck in it.
It's not a mystery what happened. This isn't like some sort of UFO that suddenly landed and made the green soft. They just put water on them. It's pretty clear. And it, so I'm going to go ahead and let both of us take a victory lap. On Friday afternoon, and I teased you about this on Saturday's podcast, so I'll go ahead and let you take your victory lap. You claimed it was over. Rory had won. And I kind of bristled at the idea. And of course, he blew the six-shot lead, but you ended up being right. So I'll let you take the victory lap. I'm going to
I'm not taking much pride in that prediction. No player besides Harry Cooper in 1936 had blown a five-shot lead at the Masters. I'm pretty sure that Roy McIlroy
is historically pulling up Harry Cooper.
Yeah. Yes. Historically, it would have been a collapse for the ages had Roy McIlroy not been able to get it done.
And it was close. So, but I will. I'll give you your flowers on that front. However, I'm going to take my flowers on the idea that you and I had this conversation on Friday, that golf course setup is not linear. There's no dictating that it has to only go in one direction. My point was they could always dial it back. The line that Augusta National can do whatever it is they want to do with the golf course, that means they can also make it a little bit softer. Now, I was thrown off. I thought for sure Saturday was going to
be. Players were thrown off. They were leaving putts short at Augusta National. You never see that.
And I thought Saturday was going to be the difficult day. I thought that's the day when you're going to see the tough pins and they're going to let the golf course get a little crispy. And then dial it back for Sunday, because that's the fun day. That's when they're supposed to go out and make the birdies and the eagles and everyone.
Saturday, the third round was the lowest scoring average in the history of the tournament. Imagine thinking that on Thursday afternoon, Rex, that 48 hours later, you were going to have the easiest third round with all the conditions. There was not even a cloud over those 4 days. The wind was really not all that extreme. We had maybe 15 mile an hour gusts for the remaining 3 days, not a drop of moisture. And yet 2 days later, 2 days after you had incredibly difficult firm conditions on Thursday afternoon, you had the easiest scoring conditions ever at the Masters on Saturday.
And I think there's something to be said for there is a new chairman of the competitions committee, and you don't know where that mindset is. Maybe the mandate was to set the golf course up a little bit different, maybe to break out of that tradition that Saturday is going to be hard and then Sunday is going to be fun day, and we're going to let them score. Or I think this is probably more realistic, the idea that given that this was the first time in 25 years that they had this forecast, that the perfect forecast, that there has been no rain virtually since last Sunday, and that was just trace rain. You and I were both standing in it. We didn't have an umbrella. We didn't have rain gear, and I don't think either one of us got wet. So you're right. They could do exactly what they wanted to this golf course. And it was hot and it was windy and the sun was out. And so you could dial that golf course down to be as firm and as fast and as punishing as you absolutely wanted to. And maybe I can imagine a scenario, and I'm not saying that this is what happened at all, but after Thursday's round, Augusta National hears the players talk just like we hear the players talk. And maybe they decided that, no, we're not going to go down that road. We're not going to let this get away from us. We're not going to let the greens turn into, I think Justin Rose's line probably spooked him the most, that maybe they'll give out a yellow jacket on Sunday as a reference to the hue of the greens. Maybe they just don't like the idea of that, because every player after that, starting on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, will tell you that, no, they were much more receptive. Like, I had a hard time getting the ball to the hole. It looked faster than it actually was. It wasn't at all what I think they expected. And maybe that's a competitive element of this. Maybe in the minds of those who are setting up the golf course, that throwing players off their game is exactly what they want to do. And that's what they got. I will say that Scotty made the point that it didn't feel like you got equal sides of the draw, that on, at least as it applies to Thursday and Friday. And you're absolutely right. Sending the best players off last on Thursday and Friday doesn't make any sense for anybody except for TV.
You're exactly right about that. And look, history's not going to remember any of this, right? Like, Rory McIlroy won the golf tournament 12 under par. That's typically where you've seen the past five or six champions are all in that sort of range. The scoring wasn't outrageous. Yes, you had the lowest third round scoring average in history, but it wasn't astronomically lower. It wasn't a shot lower than it's ever been. You only had the best score of the week was a 65. Yes, you also had some scores in the 80s as well. So again, this is all going to be forgotten. But I think Sky did have a point that the cadence and the flow of the setup was definitely unusual and a little bit atypical. And to hear a Justin Rose or a Jason Day say that the greens were, they looked fast, but they really weren't. They looked firm, but they really weren't. It was just a little bit curious over the past 54 holes, again, when the conditions were favorable for the setup crew to sort of extend or at least prolong the conditions that we saw on Thursday. They certainly have the resources to do so. Let's talk about a little of Justin Rose, who, again, Rex, was one of those leaders by two shots early on in the final round, eventually fades, makes a late bogey, and ties for third, finishing two shots back of Rory McIlroy. I guess he was spared, Justin Rose, the tidy Englishman, of another runner-up finish with would have been his fourth, but I still think this one will sting, and it all came undone in Amen Corner.
How many arms can you get in the green jacket before you just finally give up? And I'm not saying that Justin Rose is going to give up, but 45 years old, he just keeps getting better. Like, I have nothing but respect. I think the entire PGA...
You have to admire, Rex, the willingness for him to continually get his heart broken. I think that's really something to respect.
I think that's the definition of a competitor. It's putting yourself out there and time and time again in this arena at an event that clearly means the world to him. And I just think it's shocking that he does nothing wrong over the course of it. If we were to break down those three runner finishes and what happened this week, there aren't a lot of things that he did wrong. You can't point to one moment. There wasn't a John Vandeveld moment where he just completely lost his mind and made a seven and we never heard from him again. Like, he is competitive until the very end at every single one of these finishes. And I will say, and this kind of got brought up on Sunday morning during live from, and I believe it was Nota Begay who pointed out that at 45, your opportunities are starting to dwindle. Like, that's just life. And it's not judging him as a player and as an athlete, because I think he has taken better care of himself and gone to the extremes. I would say, by comparisons to sports, he is the LeBron James of golf, not by what he's accomplished, but by what he does to make sure he can compete day in and day out. That trailer, that van that he has is absolutely amazing. And it's all about making sure he can compete at 45 years old against players, and players we're just about to talk about, that are young and athletic and are coming for his stuff. That's just the way this works out. It is painful to watch time and time again. You and I are the storytellers. And as we sat in the media center today and sort of watched the action, I think both of us, as you pointed out, went through the possible storylines. And I thought Justin Rose was going to be one of the absolute best storylines because of his history here. To come close so many times, and look, this wasn't going to be Jack in 1986 at 46 years old, because Jack was considered by most people washed when he won in 1986. 46 was ancient back in the day. It is certainly not the case now, but it would have been pretty cool. It would have been pretty cool in the context of, look how young the tour is trending. Look at all the things you have to do to be a modern tour professional. And yet Justin Rose continues to do it time and time and time again. I think you're right. This one's going to stay.
Yeah, that's a great distinction to make. Justin Rose has won twice in the past 8 months on the PGA Tour. If anything, he doesn't quite have the week-to-week excellence that he certainly did during his prime and the sort of form that vaulted him to world number one in the late 2010s. But he certainly knows how to peak, and he certainly knows how to peak at Augusta National as well. I think back to 2025 and what cost him that tournament. Keep in mind, he was a 36-hole leader, was taking 37 putts on that Saturday and shooting 75, ended up dropping seven shots behind. And yes, he got a ton of help from Rory McIlroy. And yes, he could have won that golf tournament had a couple of things fallen differently. However, he still shot 66 and played the golf that he had always dreamed about and just got denied in the playoff. 2026 to me, Rex, was a little bit different, where you look at over the first three rounds, Justin Rose really, I wouldn't call it struggling, but just sort of plateaued, or he's just sort of neutral on the greens. From a ball striking standpoint, he was phenomenal, averaging 14 greens in regulation every single round, just continually putting himself in position on a golf course that he knows how to attack. He knows where to play from. He knows the green lights. He knows the red lights, and he knows where to be a little bit cautious. So to see him jump out to the advantage, and again, he was two shots ahead as he was making the turn here. What really came undone was on 11, 12, and 13. On 11, he said afterward he was uncommitted from the middle of the fairway, was kind of stuck with what he wanted to do. The club and his line, ended up hitting a huge block out to the right and a very difficult up and down that he could not quite manage. On 12, an interesting spot as well, sort of misjudged the wind, ends up long and left, said that there was actually a pine cone that was nestled up against his ball. He would have tried to move it if he could, was a little concerned about that. Ended up hitting what was sort of like a toe hook with his chip shot and couldn't quite pull it off. Makes bogey that way. Hits what looks like, Rex, one of the shots of the championship on 13. Really gutsy, over the creek, about 20 feet past the pin. Landed right next to the hole. Ends up going 20 feet behind. Misreads not one, but two putts. The eagle putt and the birdie putt. Walks off with a par there. So going bogey, bogey, par. That was the end of his tournament. Also adds a late bogey on 17 to keep him out of the runner-up position. But I think all in all, a very encouraging performance for Justin Rose, even if he's going to have to wait another year to get another crack at the green jacket. How about Cameron Young, the player, Rex, who was in the final group with Roy McIlroy, shoots a 73. Again, two shots clear when he was standing on the seventh tee. What did you make of Cam's first time in that position in a major championship in about 3 or 4 years?
You just made a reference to our lack of scripting on this show. And I agree, we have a lack of scripting. However, the idea was we were going to do like a three things that you missed. And my top thing was, you can't see my notes. It says Cam Young, and all it says is dude. He's an absolute dude. And oh, I think...
I thought it was like, dude. Like, dude, no. What happened?
He's no. in football. Like, he's an absolute dude. When you look at what he was able to accomplish, and I think both you and I have talked about this the last 2 days a lot, what he was able to accomplish at the Players' Championship in dominant fashion. I keep going back to the drive on 18 just because I think that's the coolest thing I've seen in golf in a really long time. Not only to hit a good drive on 18 with the Players' Championship on the line, to hit the best drive ever, or at least in recorded history at that particular tournament, that's a statement in my mind. What he was able to accomplish this week, and I was in the scrum with him with the media afterwards, and I think the stats back this up. He didn't putt particularly well. He chipped in. He made a couple of putts that were decent, but by and large, I don't think anybody would say his putting performance was up to snuff. I think what he proved to himself this week is that he is ready to take that next step. And the next step is a major championship, obviously. And we talked a long time about him being the best player probably on the PGA Tour without a victory. And he took care of that last year at the Wyndham Championship. What he was able to accomplish at the Ryder Cup, I would argue between he and JJ Spahn, they were the lone two bright, you know, stars on that team last year at Bethpage. And now to take this step, look, he's going to sit and sort of dissect this round for a long time, because there's a lot of things that could have gone his way that didn't. But really, this boils down to you just didn't make the putts when you needed to, but you were right there. And I think that's encouraging for a player like Cam Young.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And look, Cam Young's going to look at what happened over the first seven holes of this golf tournament, going out in 40 and having to scrap his way back. Keep in mind, had Cameron Young won the Masters while being in a tie for 33rd after the opening round, that would have matched Tiger Woods in 2005 as the worst starting position for an eventual champion. So the way that he even got himself back into contention for this, shooting 67-65 in the middle rounds. Yes, the putter betrayed him. Yes, his driver was a little bit more wayward on Sunday. He had missed, Rex, just five fairways over the first 54 holes while being top 10 in driving distance. I mean, the guy is a cheat code. When he's on, he is as good as anyone in the sport. This is just the first four rounds of a 16-round major championship season. Cameron Young's time is coming, and I'm certainly here for it. Wanted to give a shout out to Colin Morikawa, who, when I talked to him on Monday, did not even know if he was going to be playing in the golf tournament because of the back issue that he suffered at the Players' Championship, limps his way to a tie for seventh. You certainly have to wonder how he would have performed had he been in full fitness. But Rex, two players that we did not see all that much on the weekend. One wasn't even here for the weekend, was Bryson DeChambeau, made two triples in the first two rounds, bowed out and missed the cut. And John Rahm tied for 38th, your pick to win. Which of those storylines really stood out to you most?
That also was in my notes, because I did want to point out the idea that these are by far, in a way, the best two players on LIV Golf. And we've seen it. We've talked about the idea that adding, going to 72 holes on LIV Golf was going to only benefit the top players. And we've seen that. Bryson DeChambeau has won twice. John Rahm has won once. John Rahm hasn't finished outside the top five. Both of those players have benefited from this. And I think I made the argument that when I picked John Rahm to be my favorite, that going to 72 holes was also going to allow him to prepare better for the major championships, because I think there is a narrative that maybe 54 holes wasn't exactly the best way for him to prepare for major championship golf. There were a lot of reasons that I thought that John Rahm should have been the person to go to. I keep going back to the idea that neither one of those players showed up. Neither one of those players delivered. We can sit and have the debate, and this isn't LIV Golf versus the PGA Tour, because I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. But the fact of the matter remains is the PGA Tour's top players, they did arrive. Cameron Young played really well, your player's champion. Scottie Scheffler, the world number one, played really well. Rory McIlroy, the sort of the standard bearer for the PGA Tour, he ended up winning. We can keep going down the list. Like, they delivered. And Hatton from LIV Golf played really well as well. He finished inside the top 10. I'm not taking anything away from that. But it seems like time and time again, we're having this conversation about these specific two players when it comes to them getting on a stage that's not LIV Golf. And I'll go back to the Olympics in Paris. And I had a colleague that said this to me going into that final round. If you remember correctly, John Rahm had a pretty commanding lead. And it seemed like he was sort of destined for a gold medal, if not a medal. Like, he was going to end up on the podium. It didn't seem any doubt about that. But this colleague said this is going to be John Rahm's most important round, because this is the only round, the last round of the year, that people are going to remember. Again, I'm not getting into the LIV Golf debate. That's not what this is about. This is just about facts. What people remember. They remember major championships. They remember the Players' Championship. And they remember the Olympics in this particular case. John Rahm played his way off the podium that day. I think there is an added pressure for these players, Bryson DeChambeau, John Rahm, any of the players coming from LIV Golf. When they show up at these majors, I feel like they need to make a statement. And in the back of their mind, they're adding pressure to what is already a pressure-packed situation. And this is just another episode of that.
Yeah, I mean, John Rahm, by playing for LIV, only has four sort of career-altering opportunities each year. So to your point, there is so much pressure on each and every one of those to maximize them as one who is a historian of the game. And you just look, and just look at the facts. Since John Rahm moved to LIV Golf at the beginning of the 2024 season, his win rate, his top three rate, his top five rate, his top 10 rate in the major championships has significantly suffered in this new era. So that's either really bad timing for John Rahm to have these performances that he's having in the major championships, or he's not being properly battle tested on a weekend and week out basis on the circuit in which he is playing. As it relates to Bryson DeChambeau, a couple strange melts in the bunker on 11 and the bunker on 18. I'm not worried about Bryson DeChambeau. I think with the other major championship venues, it will be better suited for him in his iron play. All right, after this short break, we'll give our final thoughts on the 2026 Masters. Again, a tournament, the Rex Hager, called an A+. All right, Rex, so concludes our week in Augusta. Shout out to Jason and Susie for the hospitality, as always, while we have been in town. 2026 Masters is in the books. What are you going to remember most?
It always delivers, like time and time again. And I gave it an A+, and I don't even think that was hyperbole. I think when you look at the way this week sort of played out, and not just that Rory McIlroy won, that was a very good storyline. There was plenty of other storylines, though, is my point, that you and I sat in that media center on Sunday afternoon kind of going a checklist. And there are other majors, there's other tournaments where there's probably players on that board that you and I don't necessarily want to write or talk about. However, this wasn't the case. There were so many good, compelling stories, so many things to talk about. The golf course, you can start there. The idea that it was going to be firm and fast, that we haven't seen conditions like this in 25 years. The quality of players, that Scottie Scheffler, as you pointed out, had an awful Friday, 12 strokes back to start the weekend, and somehow puts himself into contention. And now Rory has become, I think Brandel Chamblee put it best on Saturday Night During Live From, he's one of those masters now. The type of player that you talk about that is very, really good. You're always going to, you know, be among the top 5 or 10 favorites that you're going to pick, but there's just some sort of switch that flips with him. And he is kind of inching in that category, that his history here before winning last year and now back to back, I think he's there.
I think we were all a little bit worried about a potential letdown just because the 2025 Masters was so incredible. It was so compelling. It was so intriguing. It was so historic. It was so consequential. And you've sort of fast forward a year, and all of a sudden you had Scotty, who wasn't in the best form that we've seen over the past couple of years. You had Rory, who was a little bit of a question mark. Last time we saw him at the Players' Championship, he was dealing with a back injury. We had questions of whether a Ludvig Åberg or a Cameron Young or a Matt Fitzpatrick were going to take the next step. We got answers to all of those questions, which is why the Masters is my favorite tournament of the year. It's the most fun to cover. The golf course and sort of the high risk, high reward nature of it always seems to deliver as well. And I also love, Rex, just sort of the communal nature of covering this golf tournament. We have a big family of golf show that we had. You and I were both in positions that we'd never been on Live From. That was a lot of fun as well. You see all the celebrities who are under the tree and out watching golf and enjoying golf, and all the Masters has to enjoy as well. It was certainly a great week, and we're glad that you guys were a part of it. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. We'll be back on Wednesday for a sort of rehash what happened at the Masters, and also a preview of the RBC Heritage. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. Talk to you guys in a couple of days.